this would be probably my last poetry reading at Holden Village, and it's good to have it on Easter. I'd just like to read about six poems, shorter poems, today, and then the long poem that was written about a year and a half ago, a poem that I feel like, that I really couldn't have written had I not come to Holden Village for 6 years and been up here for 6 years and taught particularly in close contact with Carol Mary Hindley during these years. And I would like that poem to center this reading today for nostalgic reasons, perhaps. But I would like to precede that with reading five poems. I'd like to start with the last poem first. The last poem I wrote was in January. I've told some people that I write a number of poems in a very short period of time, and then I go through long time where I don't write poems at all. And that's one way that poems are written. This poem is called 1700 Miles to Elise. I was in Northfield, Minnesota, 58 below zero, this January, and Elise and our children were back here. And we had just had our third child, Joshua, and he was only 6 weeks old. And to leave the new child and the two that I'd already grown to love and Elise and then be in this place teaching for a month was quite an experience. I was staying in another person's house, another family's house, much like the kind of house that I would probably have were I in their situation, teaching, say, at St. Olaf. And yet, because it was a family's house and because I was the only one there, there was a certain poignancy about just being there that I wouldn't have had I stayed in a motel or something like that. I think the only image in this poem that might take a little statement is that when you're a husband and father, you're always greeted when you come home. There's somebody there. And you never have to find a key to your own home. The door is always open. And that image, which I'd never thought of before at all, started to be quite a moment for me as I'd come home every day and you have to find a key to go into my shelter. And that image is in this poem. Elise teased me and said, yeah, that's a love poem, but you're talking about yourself. And so you're only talking about yourself. And she was teasing because she knew better. But it is a poem talking about an emptiness that it is talking about me by Miss Elise. And it's about the emptiness there. And the emptiness is so big that I think it is a love poem to a pretty big lady. Miles to Elise. I did not always lean so forward to a page, to speak a word so far to find you, past my crowded eyes, emptied of your face, caught double in the iris and my heart. I did not always have to find a key, unlocking my house door, with you not there inside to welcome with at least a touch of or image in my eye more live than walls. I did not always have to bear such silence, since before we met and merged and married, to unfold four more voices to embrace within the ears, deaf-mute, empty rooms. I did not always only feel the head's weight bearing down and table wood beneath my arms, and only non-committal clothes against my skin, and never anything but air against my face. I did not always miss the climbing up of children on my life with you alone, yet now all hands would find a greeting there for a grip upon my hair, my hands, my heart. I did not always have to arm myself against a dearness that now threatens to dissolve my form and words so far away from being flesh. I did not always hang or live on every word. next poem is the next to the last poem I wrote. It's called The Near Side of Risk.
Can I ask you a question? There are four voices.
Yeah, you caught that too. Well, it's good listening. You know I have three children. I was, since I have no real desire to stop here, there may be another. Three was, the first thing I put down was four, and then in the proofreading I said, well, and what I intended was that Elise and I came together and then came apart, and there were two voices outside my own. And came together, came apart, and there were three, came together, came apart, there were four. But from my point of view, there are four voices, and there are four more voices in my life. But then I said that that could, for people who knew that I had three children, and that is a little bit more difficult an image. I said, well, let's try it and see, you know, just change it to three. And then you can notice how the sound changes when you go three. Met, immersed, and married to unfold three more voices to embrace. It changes the sound. And I went back and used the four because the open OU sounds are the sound that goes with the sense of that. So it goes, we met and merged and married to unfold four more voices. See? And the E is a very nasal sound for that series.
Once you become acquainted with that other voice, you can't take it away and say something.
Yeah, you can't say it. Yeah, that's right.
Huh?
Yeah, that's right. Lisa and I met, merged, and married to unfold that in. I don't know if I should be insulted or not. At least I'm a man, so you can't call me a father of a bitch, but he's a male, I should say. But anyway, that was a choice, very clearly a choice. The initial thing was four, maybe at least in three kids, and then I realized that three would be more accurate, and then I made the choice of sound over the autobiography, because very clearly I want. In writing, you seek the balance between sound and sense, and that when you start to think of it, these are things in poetry that you don't really know are there until you start to look. But each word is—it's a whole series of about, I think it's eight words, each with that same pensive, but possibly pensive, possibly sorrowing sound, empty sound, and then I want that contrast, and then the next line, see, contrasts with that, where you're talking about silence, and you invert the sense, and then you say, in the next line, you're ready for that pounding, ears, deaf, mute, empty rooms, you know, you're ready for that bang, 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 a loud silence. So, that's some of something there. By the way, feel free to, you know, if you have some question or want a line read again or something, just feel free to ask. This next one, Near Side of Risk, many people have experienced this. Okay, it's a very common experience, I think, to look out the window and think that there's got to be at least 1,000 miles between you and the tree that's outside. You feel a... you're very distant from the world. You're inside your head and you look out and it's very far away. Sometimes you don't need to look through a window to get that thought or feeling that you can just, I can just look at you and miles away, you know. You realize the tremendous distance between two human beings. The ambiguity and the mystery is what's emphasized, not the commonality, not that we have shared. There is a connection, but the separation is emphasized innocent. And when one does experience that, like say between people, that tremendous distance, you know, there's you want to shorten that distance, and it involves a risk to do that. You're afraid, and yet you have responded to that person in some way so that you want to get over to that person, and so there's a love there too. Hopefully this makes sense. I think it'll explain itself here in the poem. And I feel this way and you're there, and there's something between us, and that's risk, involves risk. And the near side of risk is here. The far side of risk is over there. And the sense that we're so far apart is poignant. It's even more poignant that probably from talking about people, that person may be feeling very much the same way. So if there are two people on the other, you know, 5 feet away from each other, with this sense of love and fear involved, and they can't somehow go through that risk, it's really poignant. And then maybe it's exciting to know that even though one doesn't do anything, one can, by what one thinks about that situation, actually connect with the, or appreciate perhaps the other even more by knowing what's true about them too. Well, let's try this. Sounds awfully abstract. This is not an abstract poem, though. The near side of risk. It's looking out the window. There is no wind outside, and it is silent in my room. The light is brighter there. I am clearly here. Beyond the window is a pine whose green, the ground snow, makes rise surer from its small ring of noon shadow. My mind offers no specific speech. The tree means nothing, yet green is not word enough for pine. To disturb this ordered silence would be a task that took one through the window pane to where words enough wait for the paired brain thrown through the ragged glass of risk. I know that abandon keeps skin taut with heart, and that order keeps the blood from running out. Just so, the weight of love and fear pins both tree and mine. I would that I could cause this singular tree out there to go wild in you, freeing the famous pine lodged in your own mind to burst through your living. At least these words may prove enough to start your day, and all in it, trembling on the tip of your tongue, as this fool pine trembles on the tip of mine, loud with abandon, and still with order, on the far side of risk, heavy with fear and love. Next poem is an Easter poem with no Christian symbolism in it, or Christian language in it, but it's about a death and resurrection, or the beginning of a resurrection. And I'm talking about myself as if I were land used up. Has anyone ever seen land that's just been, you've grown, you say, out east you can see some of this land that they've grown tobacco on, tobacco for, you know, 60 years every year, and finally it's just done. You know, it's used up. Sometimes my life has felt like that. Sometimes I'm sure all you people's lives have felt that way. And yet, you know, the earth does come back. There's stuff growing on the Bikini Island where the first H-bomb went off. That was great news a few years ago. It started coming back. life just started moving up out of the sea again. The earth is ready. It is ready to be wed. It's ready to be to produce. Sometimes we get in situations to where our lives go stale, but as creatures, we're not made for impotence and sterility, and that life can come back. Well, first stanza talks about the I'm like a dried up field, land used up. The next stanza is a true story from down here in Lake Chelan. The one winter there was a terrible frost, and everyone thought that the trees would be killed. A very deep frost. It's never usually get that cold here. And they said, for sure, these trees are going to die. And they didn't die. That fall was one of the greatest harvests of all time. They said, well, they'll die next year. They didn't die. The next one was the greatest, you know, another huge harvest. And they said, well, great, fantastic. They didn't get the trees. The next fall, they all died. The trees died. But those crazy trees didn't die until they had made sure to put twice as many seeds in the ground as they normally did. That was a triumph of the spirit of the apple trees. That image reminded me, I mean, that even a tree can not give up. Well, then what about me? And then, so that helped me, and then the last stanza is one saying, no, there's new life coming in me again, too. Just started. It's a death and resurrection poem. It's called Like Land Used Up, and this one was in the Iowa Review a few years ago. Like land used up. Like a plane still holding meadow curves, but brown, and seen from one personal place in the broad palm of it, I am, with all blades stooped in a uniform lean, like stalks crushed or blight-bent wheat. The heart went out of it, all at once, all over, and still, the still picture of it is waiting, waiting like a long dead tree still waits, signed to a whole life spent learning to stand in one place so deep it is hard to forget. Once an apple orchard died without a sign in middle season, 2 years and two bounty harvests, after one sharp freeze grows earth past deepest roots, killing all from the bottom up, but not before, 2 years' grace wore threat out in double seed in earth that was always ready to wed. No, not like land, used up is my present plane. More like dues for shallow root pudding in an irrigate easy life. And as I say it, yes, I am not in one place. Yes, out there, past target zero, there is a small green that is mine. I can tell, like newborn fingers starting to move before eyes open. Such a blue child I must have seemed. But watched, the fingers begin to move all over, beyond the palm, like secrets beginning to tell. Okay. Yeah.
Read it again.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Well, okay. Thank you. There's an image in the end. Lucy was blue when she came out. She was breech and very blue child. And so I watched the first baby. I was there and helping in this Lamaze thing method. And baby came out and Lucy was just blue and didn't breathe and he couldn't get her started, you know. And there's this moment there where real anxiety. And the doctor started rubbing her. And then it was like the sun came up on her, you know. But finally, the color came to her eyes and an upper forehead and just washed down all down her body, you know, and then those fingers. And then, whoa! celebration. And that's the image here. And target zero is an image that might be a little difficult. It's like when you drop a bomb on someplace, target zero is right where you aim, you know, there. And that's usually what's just wasted more than anything else. And it's also, to me, it's an image of what my life is like when I'm so really mired in myself, self-conscious and so forth, zero, baby. And it's just about as fertile as target zero in Hiroshima. And so that's an image there. Like a plane still holding metal curbs but brown, and seen from one personal place in the broad palm of it, I am, with all blades stooped in a uniform lean, like stalks crushed or blight bent wheat. The heart went out of it all at once, all over, and still the still picture of it is waiting, waiting like a long dead tree still waits, signed to a whole life spent learning to stand in one place so deep it is hard to forget. Once an apple orchard died without a sign, in middle season, 2 years and two bounty harvests after one sharp breeze froze earth past deepest roots, killing all from the bottom up, but not before 2 years' grace wore threat out in double seed in earth that was always ready to wed. No, not like land used up is my present plain, more like dews for shallow root putting in an irrigate easy life. And as I say it, yes, I am not in one place. Yes, out there, past target zero, there is a small green that is mine. I can tell, like newborn fingers starting to move before eyes. Such a blue child I must have seemed, but watched, the fingers begin to move all over, beyond the palm, like secrets beginning to tell. I guess the obvious image there is that if you've been out, you can see these dead trees out in the country, and you can look, and there's this dead tree, and you say, oh boy, you know, and then you look on the ground.
Okay.
You know, the little tree starting, and starting up all over. This next one is called, it's a short little poem called The Rain Falls On, and it's a poem written out of real need and dryness and self-pity in a sense, but not just self-pity. Self-pity, I think when you feel self-pity, you feel like there's nothing there to help you, and this is very much like self-pity, but it very clearly knows that there's help on its way. The image is just the moon. You can look at the moon at night, and then when it's going to rain tomorrow, you know, as the story goes, there's a circle around it, you know? And so in a way, if I look tonight and see the moon with a circle around it, then the rain is starting to fall already and it'll reach me tomorrow. Does that make sense? And here's the signal that it's going to rain, so in other words, it started to rain, and then if I just wait and have patience, the rain will come again and new life will come back into my life. That's the one image, and that's the positive image that the moon has at that time. The other image is one that's, to me, the moon strikes me as a number of ways, but I just talk about two of them. One, it's a breast image to feed me, you know, especially with the corona. And then it's an eye, a crying eye. There's a sadness about the moon, too. It's like an eye, and that there are tears falling. And so those two images I'm using here. And James, in the epistle of James, he talks about the tongue as the root of good and evil alike. And this poem is written to ask for a happier poem, a livelier poem. The rain falls on. The indiscriminate eye of a veiled half-moon nurses vaguely from its blind white, ringed with the signal sienna corona of tomorrow's rain set falling tonight from the eye of that child, from that mother's breast, promising to come the long way grown between us now. Moon, may tomorrow prove your milk and tears have found my open hollow mouth and filled that root of good and evil alike to make a greener word, a world the rain falls on. Once I killed 36 birds. I was 11 years old. In one afternoon, I killed 36 birds. A horrible feeling, and to know actually some of what went on in me while I did it is even more horrible than the birth. Never heard that many birds. Everybody has something like that in their past, I imagine. Maybe not with animals, killing animals, but clearly one has destroyed. Usually in the childhood, something like that is at that point when you're a boy and you're not yet a man, and you have a great deal of what would be called socially feminine in you. You have a great deal of what's socially masculine in you. And the genders are sort of at war. And there's a great, at least in this thing in my past, there was a tremendous erotic quality about killing. And I think that the psychiatrist could find that, unfortunately, that does not end in childhood. A sense of power. Becker talks about that feeling of being able to destroy. Talks about that here. Now, the image of killing birds, that's pathetic that that happened. If in my own life I'd done that and repressed it, that would be pathetic. If in my own life I didn't repress it and kept remembering that with horror and with just seeing those poor little birds, that would be pathetic. But if that moment where I discovered that I was not who I thought I was went beyond that, as Tournier would want things to go beyond that, and meant a new birth in my life, that would not be pathetic, but it would be what's called comic. Not funny, ha-ha, but comic, a comedy in plays and things. Well, pathos is when one goes below the level of the human and stays there, and comedy is when one realizes one is below the level of the human and is on an ascendancy toward being human. And that's the life of a Christian, at least, is a comedy. Hopefully, it's a comedy, and it's not fantasy, and it's not tragedy, and it's not pathos, but it's comedy, and that's what this one of the things this poem is about. In A Handful of Birds, Iowa, 1957. Their feathers are brushed wet with the love like dirt on the hands. Their eyes are blue on the shed floor. Breath spreads their ribs. With a sift of stone, sparrow bones are found. Genders had fought, and their argument held a rifle to the head of childhood, blowing the wings out for years. Birds were caught in all positions, once upon a time of mouth, with heart in it, and 36 birds. The heart is out and on that floor, measured up walls away from now, with just a lump of pathos and a handful of things. And a handful of comedies left with live wings, a comedy of wars not fought but died, a comedy of angels seen not denied, and a comedy of dying that doesn't look away from the middle of a floor that's sorry with death and a history tense on the point of a rib with a measure of prayer as many as sparrows, each being enough to recall, I'm told, care. That in the Bible you have that cares about every bird. And the measure of my prayer is the measure of my that had been my slaughter recognized. Well, you can read the back against the wall. I'd like to preface this poem with a little bit of a statement. I found that it's quite against poem at times. I found that making this statement, when I was at St. Olaf, I gave a chapel talk, and I preceded reading this poem with a certain statement about one theme in the poem of separation. And it seemed that that was something that helped in the hearing of that poem a great deal, to talk a little bit about that theme. And so I will go and proceed the poem with the same thing. I want to give a Vespers service. What's an afternoon service? Matins and Vespers. But anyway, this... Evensong? Okay, let's call it Evensong. Yeah. Charles Williams has said that imagination is the play of God. The play of God. I like that. I believe that theology, too, is play. Play to be done with a self-humor that knows human limitation, and yet is done with the high seriousness of a child's play. In a moment I'll read you my first attempt to wed theology and poetry. All I hope for it is that it is, as one wag has said, either a damn fine poem and a pretty good sermon, or a damn fine sermon and a pretty good poem. The poem contains the themes of the life that is death and the death that brings life. The poem also contains the themes of separation and reconciliation with ourselves, others, the earth, and God. I'd like to warn and warm you to the theme of separation. In this poem, I've made Jesus himself experience the loss of connections that men experience on this earth. My imagination tells me that for Jesus to be fully man, the perfect communication between Father and Son that existed in heaven had to be severed and disrupted after his birth. I also have Christ in this poem separated from the creation himself and other men, separated even from himself. I think we all know that feeling when we're separated from even ourselves. And I think for him to be fully human, I wanted him to have that too. You know, Christ created the world and is in all the world, and when this separation, the first time this separation existed after his birth, when he looked at the world, it would be the first time in his life that everything he looked at wasn't him. Make sense? That's a line in the poem. Well, I have Christ sharing with man the first mature recognition that he is alone and separated from all persons, places, and things. I have these severed connections grow back as bruised nerves grow back in time after a serious fall. After Christ's connections with the Father are complete again at his baptism, that's where I put the completing of the connections, the subject of his life and the poem rightfully changes to us, the crippled, the broken, contrite. The poem breaks out into a hymn and then flows on to its final statement. I stress separation so much because so much of man's hostility is born there, in that sense of separation. Although it's A.D., the year of our Lord, and the new one at that, most of our days are lived B.C., without the reality of Christ. And in that B.C. reality, as we know good, thirst for righteousness, do bad, are scalded by guilt, we feel our separateness even more. As we recognize quality, know the eternal, thirst for immortality, fall off roofs, get sick, have friends of ours die, we increase in this separating anxiety. We experience love and meaning, know hate and meaninglessness, and fear being swallowed by the maelstrom of the latter knowledge. When face a man or woman and realize that the phrase the opposite sex is aptly chosen, we struggle with hell and the incommunicability of love and the entropy of our will and emotions. We yearn for marriage and integration and create divorce and disintegration within ourselves and our communities. We hear a voice cry in our hearts and we silence it and choose rather to put the rouge of positive mental attitude just over the skull. Or we grasp the banner of self-realization and lose sight of our brothers and sisters behind the flag of ourselves. We struggle to keep our grip on life while the only answer is to give it up, to have it broken. We cling to our equality to the best and worst definitions of ourselves that we give to ourselves, cling to the vanity of our neurosis or the vanity and blindness of our so-called healthy-mindedness. We silence the heart and the spirit of God's Son there crying out, Abba, Father. And in that silence, the separateness remains, and the hostilities grow. We want to be 10 feet tall, and so create a world of midgets and cartoons to live in. We are those who were once and often are still so far away. We often are those with our backs against the wall of our fear, backs against the wall of ourselves, backs against the wall of death. And Christ was too. His identity with us complete. It's more slowly than I normally do, because Howard Hong at St. Olaf, as some of you know him, he came home after that chapel talk and he told Edna, his wife, he said, I should have tutored the boy. Should have tutored the boy. You just can't say pregnant phrases like that so fast. Actually, I knew he was going to be there, so I slowed it down, because he did tutor me. He was one of my teachers. But not enough to suit, so I want to really slow it down this time. And we do have our backs against the wall of death, but we don't have to stay there. My back can be against the wall of death, but I can be across the room. I can be going away from that and not turning back to the blackness that's just behind me. And sort of that image from the baptism last night, I'm on water, but I don't have to look down and sink into it. I can look to Christ and just go right out over that water. Okay? Outside of myself, away from my fear that the world is not much but betrayal. Well, anyway, I better shut up and leave this point. We're back against the wall of death. God, through Jesus' heart, felt his first sadness on earth that he was no longer everything he saw. Familiarity was gone. The rising and setting sun had a strangeness. The night had a finality about it that could not anticipate creation. God, through Jesus' eyes, saw for the first time the immense dark that stood just behind the back of every born daughter or son, even his own begotten son, who was here as born as begotten and backed by the same black human fear that the whole world didn't mean a thing but death, betrayal, Gethsemane. God saw that when he lifted man's lump out of the clay earth, man became neither of heaven nor of earth, with a million connections severed from that heaven and that earth. And when he breathed life into Adam, he found him in himself as very good, but on, not in, the earth, and so alone. So Eve came out of Adam's flesh, and more connective nerves bruised closed. None of this was clear in Eden, where the very air they breathed was breath of God, but that mouth closed, and with every breath after that the race took in, came strangeness and knowledge that this is not me. And when God had his son, Jesus, born out of the world, God too was surprised at the great divorce that earth's birth meant, surprised at the long silence of his son, who for all the first years sent no glad news home as he grew against the wall into him who knew more than any man the loss of connection, the gain of knowledge, that alone in the world, he wasn't among friends. God, through Jesus' nerves, felt his son's nerve ends for the first time stop short of creatures, men, and even himself. God, in Jesus, found himself, at first numb to his own creation, found his son truly in the human predicament, with only a common hope inclined toward rejuvenation of nerve and throbbing out of numbness to the Father and his world, stretching toward connection to the pulse and sense of everything again. Through all that time of silent, growing pain, the central nerve of Jesus, faith and hope against black and human fear, slowly grew him into everything again, grew him into his Father's voice. Familiarity started coming back. He recognized himself slowly rising out of Scripture's song, his self pulling his self out of himself. And when John's broken water of baptism flowed over his head, he came out, leaving darkness behind his back, the connections complete. God heard the news, "This is my Son, in whom I am well pleased." And Jesus felt and saw the world through God's heart and eyes and nerve. He began his life of weddings and would die for his world of brides and friends, each one. He left the wall behind his back. He came out, the bridegroom of the world, as a sun rising out of night's chamber, rejoicing to run its race, wed to the world and making friends of millions of things, mongoose, mountains, cedars dancing, flies, fabulous eyes, and white water flowing, leviathans leaping to slap a word 100 miles to its mate that they trip 100 miles away. Wed, 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 wed to live out his unholy magnificent style of gladness, embracing only content of God, the beautiful cripples, the broken, contrite, whose grip on themselves had broken their hands open and turning out not the expected Pandora's box, but praise and thanks soaring up on the winds of their Father's Spirit. With their feet on the ground, their eyes, with a muscular vision, embracing the world's dullness, self-pity, boredom, and fear into bloom, embracing to bloom, midwifing praise, with backs against the wall of death, facing forward, filling the world with dimension of faith's song, refusing death's dominion over even stone, knowing even stone groans in sympathetic agony for birth of the many stuttering human gestures hesitating on the edge of death, gripping themselves, fearing the leap into the colored world, fearing the joyful skeptics run over water. Wed, 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 wed Jesus was to the world and is, wed to the sand, the stars, the friends. Wed he I do the world to life with yes. Even the humble grass replied, yes, it's good to be alive and even die on the right hand of God that is this world where Christ lives, blessing. Blessing, I repeat, this world is the right hand of God that wants to clap and man's the only other hand with sight. Attend, see, praise, thank, clap your life against the hand of God. The opened world heals with his children's joy. Praise God, the central nerves are coming back, growing back into the groan and song of all things and their many colored graces. God's laughter we are. Our name is ice. Excuse me, but this phone just gets me rolling. That's the problem with reading it slowly. God's laughter we are. Our name is Isaac. Sin's been dealt with on the cross. Now we wait for Christ's glad waiting for his second coming's glory. Death is a wall we've left behind us, opened our windows on the world. Life is present and is coming, bought and paid for, we all receive. Ready now to squander care, prodigal with his faith and hope, we spend and spend and still God fills. Even when despair is our empty purse, he fills us with laughter before our mirrors. And yes, that gladness I've been singing floods out enough room in us to grieve at slaughter, stillbirth, race loss, sorrow, caused by the stones of the death wall thrown by men, plucked from fear's contorted path. We know death's wall behind us, constant at our back, and many stones we've thrown, flying out of anxiety's dark, thrown by our fear or boredom's arrogant hand. We know the world seen by the closed heart, that heart's been ours and been our eyes that saw through all goodness to just black. We know the risk that love walks through the valley and shadow of that wall, yet we believe there are hands that hold us on both sides of life so we can die. Eat now the next to the last word of life, loss of all face in the surface of the stream, knowing no matter how or whom we loved, if we didn't eat him, we only ate each other. We ate that word. In short, we died before our time, though death was just in time, an in-time grace, or better, gift, became the last word, and the world became a gift, viewed as by dead men, precious as only those who've lost life know. Born out of the bottleneck of thought, that anxious place, where every net was cast to save our face, survive to feed that face, we now live a life born out of a breath that broke our grip and opened hands for gift. Oh, in this world, all we can do is all. Die, pray, and point the world in and outside of us to hope. That broad place of given and forgiven. With heavy hands behind, with lightened hands, and light unto our moment's feet to serve. Glad in our births, we groan toward birth, for all the world to die and live, practicing its life in heaven here, wedlocked to thankful life past death. Wedlocked to thankful life past death. But is this song all riskless, borrowed triumph, borrowed courage, borrowed laughter, stolen rightness with God on our side? No. Only the glad heart knows his suffering. Gladness in this world is risk, the greatest risk. Abba, Father, your Son lives in his nerve in us. We become as the Christ nerve grows. And forgiven with our backs against our walls, we look forward not to pie in the sky, but look forward to the reconciliation coming at us through our death and his risen life in us. Reconciliation with our brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, teachers and students, and there are no midgets or cartoons among them. They are all as rich in commonality with us as they are rich in ambiguity and mystery. We look forward also to the reconciliation with our tasks, each task being enough for Christ himself, who is not too worthy to wash our feet. We look forward to our reconciliation with this very day, born new into our senses again. We look forward into the moment, into the present moment, to see what the Father in heaven is already doing. This is true. Insofar as we die daily, we live, as he comes to make his blessings flow, far as the curse is found. You got us going to have three sermons on Easter Sunday. And one more poem that is not finished, which is maybe symbolic of something, I don't know. But Christ can say it is finished, but we never can, and that's part of our joy. This one, I fell about 32 feet once off the roof of a big old house that we bought a couple years ago. And that was a long way to fall. And it's just a real lucky thing that I lived. I ended up hardly anything. Just broken hands and some cracked stuff and minor internal stuff, injuries. And I could have been just creamed. Well, anyway, this poem is about falling. Of course it isn't about falling, but that gave occasion to the poem. But those few memories of myself on the way down, and that experience, because I didn't lose consciousness in it, although I went head first, which was really nice. I hit a roof on the way down, which helped break it, but it also threw me off head first, so just the last 15-20 feet were done like this. But anyway, it's called Making Change. And there are two meanings of that word. One, you make change, you know, you can do that without even thinking. It's very clear. And then the other is, of course, a metamorphosis or a change. There's a change in my life. And that the process in that fall somehow made a difference in my life. And it's an unfinished poem, but I like it. And it's getting, each time I read it, I make a little correction, and so it's getting there. And this will be the last poem. Making Change After Falling 30 Feet. I won't tell anything new. Everything is older than the shirt around me or you, and all we hide within, these bones, this flesh, contorted scars. Older than peculiar hands or feet, older than the mind that reads or writes. What I will tell is that when it falls, flesh is potatoes or clay pots, and the accompanying mind with its old reviews can do nothing to stop it. Relative vice and virtue become irrelevant. Character falls as fast as personality. Content falls as fast as style. Upside down in the air, all education or prayer provides to say is, I will die. The mind is very clear. Clear as buttoning shirts, tying shoes, shelving or unshelving books or groceries, throwing garbage or watering plants. Clearly, as the mind makes change, it says, I'll break my neck. And when it hits the ground, the flesh collapses like a paper cup crushed with water in it, where water is pain, 98%. It spills out of the voice box dry in waves. To fill all space, the pain expands, then curls back like a snake hit on the road into a fetal sleep, as if shocked flesh climbed up inside your skull. Okay, there is nothing. This is nothing new. Very old. There is nothing poetic about falling, except I moved my toes and saw dirt, forced a breath and felt pain happily running downhill from where it spilled, got my family back through wide eyes, joked that the flour in the clay pot lived, though the potatoes were mashed into bad jokes, and didactic speech that tells and tells nothing new, just that gratitude is waking up and the only human help. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Well, it's been fun. Good to see you here. Well, we're going to. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to talk.
You're describing an experience that's universal. We're always individual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's I guess the poems that finally carry are those ones which, I mean, there's an interesting thing about writing in poetry is that the more particular I am, the more I tell my story without any faking it, the more I'm telling your story. And that's one of the miracles of writing, is that the more particular I am, the more I'm telling your story. And it isn't that the deeper I go in myself, the closer, the more I look like you. Until I finally, in Turnier's terms, get to my person, which is created in the image of God and looks just like the person in you created in the image of God. This is crazy kinds of twins on this planet. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, got lots of mystery and ambiguity about us, but lots of commonality too. Yeah. That's a common experience. That's right. And that's this thing, this business of that second poem. You know, I would that I could cause this famous tree out, you know, this singular pine out there, this pine that's mine, to free the famous pine lodged in your own mind. You have a pine like that too. And, I used something as mundane as a tree to make the connection so that then other people, you can continue with other things that way. But anyway, in writing poems, I would that I could cause my tree to free the famous pine lodged in your own mind to burst through your living. You know, I mean, just to so that you can see it again and feel it again, that first time that you, everybody is at least, I mean, you don't go around hugging trees and stuff very often, but everybody has been struck with tree, and maybe it was 2 years old, and if the poem works, that's what hopefully poetry does, is pull the poem right out of you, you know, or pull the images and experience, your experience, not mine, but we share that same experience. That's sort of what that about, universal and yet particular.
And yet the reality is that I'm caught with a pattern that I'm constantly telling other people where I see they're at, mm-hmm. which misses them completely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't that? We had a discussion a while ago, and you said that, you know, somehow I can go around thinking that I understand people. I don't understand myself. I mean, if I just remember that every once in a while. But I think somehow it's, oh, I can understand you. I even know where your head's at. I don't know where my head's at. And I have all this inside data. You know, I've got all sorts of history to help me. And I can't do it, and yet I can think I know you in a minute, you know. And it's nuts how that works. But we do it all the time. We do it all the time.
But in a way, because of we do know and we don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like we know the last chapter, but we lost the whole first part of the book, you know? Does that make any sense? I mean, I know, in Christ, I know something about your omega, you know, the end point of you, the last thing to be said about you. I know already, but it's just all this other stuff, the rest of the book, all those other chapters that I don't know. But I do know you, and I don't. You know your whole story. Mm-hmm. Your whole story. But that sense of the person within you is something that I know that I can always connect with. The person is created in the image of God. That inside all your history, all your personality, all your roles, there's that person. And if I can talk to that person, in a sense, then you can be reminded of that person within you who you've forgotten, and that can come in and out through you more than it has, you know, for a while. And that's why we need, everybody needs each other, talking to each other as a person. And then we give birth to each other, like Socrates, midwife, you know, the person within.